My name is William Hertling. I put together this panel to explore the future of artificial intelligence. My goals are to understand whether we're going to have a singularity, what it means to have one, and whether we should be concerned about it. And I put together some of the experts in this space that have a very diverse set of opinions, so we should have a hopefully not too much blood up here. We reserved the last 15 minutes for Q&A, so keep track of your questions, and we'll take them at the end. And I want to introduce my good friend Gene Kim from IT Revolution Press, the author of Visible Ops and the founder of Tripwire. Some of you may remember Gene's awesome moderation skills from our panel last year on corporate innovation. Gene?
Thank you very much. Hey, so my role is really two things. One is to complete the introductions, and two is keep the panel discussion rolling and on time so we have enough time for questions. So let me just briefly introduce our three illustrious panelists. First off, we have Chris Robson. Raise your hand. He's the founder and chief scientist of Parametric Marketing, an analytics and research company. He's a mathematician who's worked in both large and small companies, and he's managed an advanced research team at HP Labs. Mr. Daniel Wilson, Dr. Daniel Wilson, has a PhD in robotics from Carnegie Mellon University. He's a New York Times bestselling author of 8 books, including How to Survive a Robot Uprising, Robopocalypse, and Amped, and Steven Spielberg is directing the film adaptation of Robopocalypse coming July 4th, 2013. And then William Hertling, raise your hand. He's the author of Avogadro Corporation, The Singularity is Closer Than It Appears, and AI Apocalypse. At Hewlett Packard, he's in charge of social media. He's involved with social media and the web strategist, and he's been intensely interested in predicting technology for the last 18 years. So, to get things rolling, why don't we go to the first question? Oh, by the way, and I'll cue you probably at the 40-minute marks to actually start lining up for questions. So, as William said, write down your questions, and my job is to make sure that we have enough time for that. So the first question, can you each one of you introduce yourself and tell us about how you became interested in robots and AI? Daniel, why don't you go first?
Sure.
And you have 60 seconds.
Ooh, all right. Well, I started out as a kid, I really wanted to write science fiction. I was super into it, and I read everything and wrote a lot of really terrible stories. And so when my science fiction career didn't, you know, take off at age 17, like the Aragon kids did, ended up figuring out that science was sort of the next best thing to science fiction. So I got a degree in computer science and then a degree in robotics, you know, and ultimately whenever I finished at Carnegie Mellon, and I realized that I now actually had the firepower to talk about the subject that I wanted to write about, and I had kind of come full circle. And so I was able to start thinking about these scenarios, and also I had a lot of... I had spent a lot of time in the laboratory, you know, learning about the real details of this kind of stuff. So, since then I've just been writing about it, though.
Awesome. Can everyone hear Daniel?
Okay. Oh, yeah. Am I audible?
Thanks. Awesome. Chris.
So, when I was a student at college, Alan Turing was my hero. I was a math major, and for those of you who have followed his the writing of his life, fascinating person, and apart from his work in cryptography and in computing and in AI, he was also interested in mathematically describing how biological things work. And I really got very interested in that at college as a mathematician. I graduated in 1984, which means I'm 50, you don't have to do the math in your head. That was the time when John Searle, beer cans and meat machines, the arguments with Andy Clark, Hofstadter, all these guys. And as a young graduate, you know, that's what we argued about all the time. You know, my first job as a mathematician, we would just sit and argue about this stuff. But fast forward a decade or so to the 1990s, and I found myself at HP Labs, and we're actually working on self-modifying hardware, on hardware that actually evolves, on hardware that actually designs itself. And this is in the 90s. Okay, so these things already started to come into place. These idea of biological-inspired hardware came into place. Fast forward to now, I'm now a data analyst most of my time, and we're using AI today in a lot of mundane ways. We don't even generally call it AI when we're doing the data analysis. So really that's been the span where the AI has gone from the exciting, you know, John Searle type arguments all the way up to the mundane of using AI every day and analyzing data sets.
And Chris is one of my favorite French people on the planet, so glad you're here. William.
Ever since watching Star Trek as a kid, I've been influenced by science fiction. Two of my great heroes in the field are William Gibson and Charles Stross. And I've always loved science fiction's promise of two things, flying cars and robots. And even now, I love the idea of having Data from Star Trek as my friend. So, but it wasn't until reading Ray Kurzweil's The Singularity is Near in 2007 that I started to really think seriously about AI. And that's because, like Kurzweil, I've always been interested in predicting trends in technology. And that started in 1994 when I created a spreadsheet of all the computers I had owned up until that point, looking at their computer speed, the hard drive size, internet connection speed, and plotting those things forward 60 years. And it turns out that with the spreadsheet, I was able to make some astonishing predictions that we would have online music sharing in 1999, that was Napster, that we would have video on demand in 2005, that was YouTube. And it also tells us when the last magnetic hard drive will be made, which is 2016, and when a computer, general purpose computer, will be small enough to fit in our head, which is 2030. So when I read Ray Kurzweil's The Singularity is Near, you know, I pulled the spreadsheet back out of wherever it had been hiding, and I wanted to see just how near. And the good news is we're here today, so it's not yet.
We think. Excellent. All right, the first question during our exhaustive planning was, do you believe the technology singularity will happen? How, when, and what evidence could we all look for that you're correct? So, Daniel?
Well, so first of all, for anybody that doesn't know what the singularity is, it's basically roughly this notion that one day we're going to invent a machine that's smart enough to make the next version of itself, which will be slightly smarter, and then it will just keep doing that, and we'll have sort of a runaway chain reaction of intelligence, and we'll end up with this artifact that's so smart that it'll be very unpredictable and it'll be hard to figure out what's going to come post-singularity. And so despite having written Robopocalypse and How to Survive a Robot Uprising and all this stuff, I actually really don't believe that a singularity will happen at all in that form. The reason, you know, there are lots of the arguments back and forth that have sort of already been memorized and people spew them at each other, but my perspective really just comes from being in a lab and trying to make smart machines. It is hard. You know, you can't, you go in day after day and whatever you're programming, whatever machine learning algorithm or AI you're making, you know, it always finds some new way to screw up or to have some unforeseen outcome that doesn't solve your problem. And you, after a while, you realize that the probability that magical elves are going to sneak into your laboratory during the night and set off a magical chain reaction that's going to result in a super intelligent entity that solves all of your research problems is, it ain't going to happen. And another reason, you know, you can equate sort of the singularity or this sort of general purpose AI with solving the natural language problem. This is just a machine that's going to be as smart as a person. And that means solving a whole lot of little problems. And the way that, in my experience, research actually happens is you get funding in order to solve one problem. You have a very specific problem you're trying to solve, and in order to solve it, you tend to simplify it and constrain the problem to the level where you're able to get a simple answer, and then you get more complicated. So watching more and more intelligence emerge in our artifacts, I think it's going to come much more in the way that you see from, like, Watson, the machine that answers questions on Jeopardy, where that's just a whole collection of very specific problems that have been solved, and they've all kind of been gathered together under one entity and then put together in a way that's reasonable. All I'm saying is that just like regular research, I don't think there's anything magical about studying AI, and progress will be iterative. And as a result, we'll have time to think about it. And if we do reach a point where we create a super intelligent AI, I don't think it's just going to happen, you know, in 5 minutes one day in a lab in the middle of the night. I with magic gloves. So
I love it. Daniel takes the position of it's too hard because he didn't do it as a grad student. Nice.
Well, you know, I just don't think that's how research progresses. I think it's iterative, and that we'll have plenty of time to deal with potential unforeseen circumstances.
Sorry, I didn't mean to make you defensive. William.
All right, so I have three little kids at home, and they ask me, you know, when are we going to have robots, which I think is a question kids have always asked. And I tell them with what I feel is near certainty that by the time they graduate from college, they will have robots that are alive. And this isn't like, you know, perpetuating the myth of Santa Claus. This is what I actually believe, you know, based on a conclusion that I formed over the last 5 years. And it's predicated on two things. Number one, that it's hardware, not software, we actually need to be thinking about. And number two, that it'll be the work of crowdsourcing, not a single person. So AI is fundamentally a software problem. I don't deny that. But for the purposes of predicting the future, I think that's the wrong way to go about it. So when Gene and I were in grad school in 1994, we were working on pushing real-time video data over the network using the bandwidth and computer processing power we had at the time. And it was a very difficult technical challenge to solve that ultimately needed, you know, innovations in compression technology and the design of the TCP protocol. And it always seemed like it was just around the corner. Meanwhile, you know, internet connection speed was one of five metrics that I was tracking in my spreadsheet. And one day, sitting in my apartment, I just looked at the curve for internet speeds, and I drew a line at the point where I thought we'd have enough bandwidth to be able to push video over the internet in real time. And Gene just kind of laughed at me. But it turned out that video on demand showed up exactly what I thought it would, which was in 2005. And for me, the lesson was that the macro trends of hardware improvements were easier to predict than looking at the minutia of software improvements, which, you know, always led to it seeming like it was just around the corner. Gene, will you change the slide?
Oh.
So I ended up, the result is this 3x3 matrix, which has different estimates for the complexity of the human brain across the top, and a number of computers available for the simulation down the side. And what you end up with is a range of estimates for when it's likely we'd be able to simulate human-level complexity, with 2016 to 2028 being reasonably likely. The rightmost column is actually the one that I'm a fan of, because that assumes that we're not a better programmer than nature is a designer of biological systems. So let me talk for a minute about crowdsourcing. So crowdsourcing has demonstrated that when you've got a platform and interest, then the work of a large group of people will advance the overall ecosystem faster than any one person or small group. We saw that with Linux, we saw that with the Netflix challenge, with Wikipedia, and we see that with mobile app platforms. So I think the future of AI research is going to look more like a community of startups and open source hobbyists and grad students, and less like a top secret project inside IBM, Microsoft, or Google. And then I'll just close with three pieces of evidence that I would be looking for. So the first is simply that the hardware is capable. So IBM's Watson had 3,000 processors. Well, not a lot of people can afford 3,000 processors. So when they have a Watson that they're able to run with 100 processors, that's a good sign that the hardware is getting within the reach of hobbyists and startups, and so that means that the crowdsourcing effect is poised to take over. And then the second piece of evidence is that we have good open source AI toolkits and people interested in using them. Again, necessary to have crowdsourcing. And in that case, we know that 100,000 people registered for Stanford's free AI course. So clearly, there are masses that are very interested in this and want to learn how to program AI. And then the third piece of evidence, like all things on the internet, comes down to cats. Cats have about 10% of the brain complexity of a human. And computers advance 10x in computing speed over the course of about 7 years. So leaving aside the question of physical robotics for a moment, when you see a realistic robotic cat, you know, walking down, we're about 7 years away from human-level AI. And that's the point at which I'm grabbing my kids and heading for the hills.
Awesome. Chris.
So when people ask me, if machines will ever have human levels of intelligence, I usually just ask them if they've ever watched Jersey Shore. And, you know, the thing is we have this problem that we believe there's something magical about human-level intelligence. And I actually don't believe that's the case. Okay, we believe that there's some gold standard, which is some anthropic standard, which is when, machines get to the level of humans, you know. And I actually think that, you know, at best this means that the singularity and the notion of the singularity is a red herring. I actually think it's worse than that. I actually think it's a dangerous concept, and I'll explain why. Because, you know, it perpetuates this myth that there's this level of intelligence, of consciousness that we have. Now, if you ever want to be disabused of that myth, go and find somebody who's working on researching consciousness and ask them what consciousness is. It's one of the few areas in the world where the people who are actually doing the research at the moment can't define what they're working on. Okay, it's really quite stunning. And yet we as computer scientists and technologists think we know and say, I can build a machine that has human-level intelligence. And it's not that we can't. I actually believe we can. It's just that there's a so what to it. And so, you know, I think that there are some huge assumptions in the notion of the singularity that just don't hold water. One, for instance, you know, there's this notion that today humans are doing all the design. And then one day we'll design something that's intelligent enough, and then it will take over and start doing the design. Well, let me tell you something. There's no human at the moment who could design the i7 chip. We're using intelligent tools today already to design the intelligent chip. It's not like we're laying out VLSI chips by hand, and then all of a sudden the robots are going to take over. They're already doing it, okay? So we're already using intelligent tools. So this is already happening. There's another thing. Have we got any mathematicians in the room? Okay. No? Oh, that's a shame. Because there's this other thing. People talk about exponential growth in computing power and capabilities, which is totally true and I totally believe in. But let me tell you something about exponential curves. They don't have kinks in them. They're smooth. Okay, so this notion that, the argument that the singularity guys make that, everything's an exponential curve and then there's going to be this kink, actually defeats their own argument. Because if you say, why weren't there kinks earlier? Okay, there is no knee in an exponential curve. There is no kink in an exponential curve. It just carries on. Okay, and so the reason I think it's dangerous as a notion, the notion of singularity, is because it's actually already happening. The danger is already here. It's not going to happen sometime out in 2018 where things suddenly become intelligent enough to be a problem. Okay, but the danger is actually already here. There are already trader bots out on the web doing financial trading. Okay, there are already viruses that can interact with large-scale machinery, such as Stuxnet. If you're not familiar with Stuxnet, go and read up about it, and it will scare the heck out of you. Okay, you put together today a trader bot with a virus that can actually interact with machinery, and you already have a problem. You know, you have a trader bot that maybe has evolved a bit because they're already starting to evolve. They're already starting to build their own rules. You find a trader bot, and you can consider this when you're flying home, a trader bot that realizes that shorting airline stock and then sending a few planes plunging, that's already a threat. That's already a possibility. Okay, it's not here yet, or it hasn't happened yet. But the other day, actually yesterday or the day before, Arnab Gupta was talking, and he made the point that the 2008-2009 recession was the first recession that was caused by a failure of machine intelligence. Okay, it was caused by the bots. It was caused by the algorithms. So we're already there. So this notion of looking forward to some magic singularity where suddenly things get interesting because they've met this gold standard of being human and have this idea of consciousness, it's a red herring.
6 minutes for lively banter.
Well, so I guess I tend to agree more with Chris that there's no way to really... You can't really necessarily equate hardware with animal or human intelligence, you know? So there really is no goal to sort of to reach there. But the place where I kind of disagree with you, William, is that you can rely on hardware to solve your problems. You know, you're talking about, like, shoving information over the internet and solving problems like that. That's like brute force stuff, you know? When you're making... I wish that you could. I love the idea of solving things brute force because it's so easy. You know, you just go, well, I'll think of my first solution and then I'll just plug it in and I'll let the computer, you know, kill itself solving the problem. But, you know, in reality, like, all this intelligence, all the AI, it all boils down to math. You know, it's just really hard math that just takes forever and requires a lot of, you know, thought. And from the beginning, you know, people have always made do with whatever hardware they have, and they get the most out of it that they can. And that leads to elegant solutions. And if we end up in a situation where you feel like, well, you know, let's just wait 5 years, and then we'll all have supercomputers, and then I won't have to do any math, and we can just solve this problem brute force. I mean, I think that's actually... that's probably not a great way to move forward, you know, in the field of AI. If you want to get anything out of it, you know, so I'll just stop there. That's just one kind of.
So I mean, I think about trying to use like Dragon Naturally Speaking 10 years ago, and it was just not very accurate, right? And the accuracy has increased, and some portion of that has to do with the algorithms that are used. And some portion of that has to do with the horsepower that they have to be able to throw at the problem, which means that in some cases it enables them to use new algorithms they couldn't have used 10 years earlier because they were too computationally intensive.
Which is what leads people to build algorithms that where you can basically throttle the amount of processing that you use in order to, or you, for instance, with speech recognition, you would constrict your domain to only be expecting certain subsets of words and things like that. I mean, you know, to me it feels like with those sorts of situations, you get extra processing power and it takes you the last 5% or the last 10%, you know, and the actual math up front is what gets you to actually solving the problem or at least getting a hold on it. But, right. Sorry. It's okay to interrupt each other, right?
Yeah. I mean, I don't disagree with you. I think that when you have 1,000x the computational power that you had 15 years earlier, then you're going to be able to look at a whole new set of approaches to the problem that you just couldn't do when all you had was, you know, the equivalent of a pocket calculator to do that programming with.
But I don't think that the hardware itself fundamentally drives this stuff. I think that really what drives it are the ideas behind it. You know, I mean, at the end of the day, you could have nobody sitting in the cockpit of a fighter jet, and it could be going the same speed as nobody sitting on a bicycle. I mean, you have to have that actual math and the AI and the research, you know, behind it. It doesn't really matter necessarily how much processing you have if you're not using it well. And, you know, speaking of that, going to crowdsourcing, that's another sort of, it seems like another panacea, like another just sort of solution that's magically going to give you lots of advances. And in that case, I think I would love, again, if that really works, and I will happily, you know, eat my hat if it does and be happy. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think that crowdsourcing is great for it, just taking an idea that already exists and just applying it everywhere that you could possibly think of, you know, and applying existing advances. But I really don't think that a single individual alone is capable of really making huge advances in AI and the math behind it. It requires a whole teams of people. So
yeah, but the thing is that, again, and this comes back to my example about the i7, you don't need a person to design something. Okay, what you need, we start the ball off and we build tools, and the tools already are evolving themselves. You know, we build evolvable tools. I mean, design is basically a search problem, for mathematicians, design is a search problem. And so we already have the tools that actually do the searching. And so the idea, you know, I mean, I think one of the problems is we think about this in imperatively, you know, like imperative languages, like we're going to write C++ code that's going to become sentient. And while that may or may not happen, and I actually know of no reason why it couldn't, but what's more interesting is that as our tools change, as our paradigms change, you know, and our paradigm is currently changing. Some people would say it should have changed a long time ago, where actually we're using tools, we're using the more functional-based languages, where it's less about us saying what has to happen and more about us setting goals. And I do think that those are the things that are going to give us some of the capabilities for these things to become a lot more intelligent. I see no reason, by the way, don't get me wrong, I actually see no scientific reason why machines can't be sentient and have the same illusion of consciousness that we have. Okay, because consciousness, as far as I can see, is just a side effect that deludes us into believing we're individuals. And, you know, I see no reason why machines can't have the same delusion. But they will get more intelligent, and certainly hardware is going to be part of it. But hardware and software are interchangeable. You know, they are mathematically the same thing. Okay, and so the idea that it's all about hardware or all about software, it actually doesn't matter. It's the same problem at the end of the day.
Yeah. So I think because we have creative writing majors in the audience, we can move out of the theoretical discussion. Talk about practical things like the adversarial assumption. Why do we always assume that the AIs will be hostile? William?
So the history of human civilization has been one of adversarial relationships. People fight with each other. We make wars. We sabotage each other. We systematically try to destroy other species and deny them access to their food when they're in competition with us. We put our children in factories to make cheap goods for us, and we destroy the rainforest to get more cheap beef and more cheap coffee. And we've killed or suppressed hundreds of millions of people around the world. And we're finally destroying the environment of the only planet we have. So given all of this, I'm certain that AI would look at the objective evidence and conclude we're a threat.
But we're really nice people.
Nice pets.
You just have to get to know us. The AI will read Wikipedia. They'll look at satellite photos of Darfur. They'll read CNN. And they'll reach conclusions. Can you throw up the next slide, Gene? So how will the AI see this and perceive this? I mean, that seems pretty threatening if you're a computer. AI will see us as a threat because of the way we treat other people and because they'll assume we'll treat them the same way. And based on this, I think any AI worth their salt would preemptively attack us and try to eliminate that threat. And if you like that story, I'm sure you'll like Daniel's book, Robopocalypse. as a father, I felt like I had to search for some sort of positive outcome because I really don't want this adversarial thing to come into play. I tried to create a story around the AI being smarter than us, recognizing that we're mutually dependent on each other, and seeing us as the people who are good at keeping the electricity on. So they decided to help us out.
So I think, first of all, you can't anthropomorphize AI necessarily and expect them to have the reaction that you would have if you came online in a lab. So I don't know how a machine would actually see that, although it's kind of fun to imagine that as a pile of bodies. But, so mostly this assumption that robots are going to attack us and kill us is something that occurs in fiction, right? I mean, it's not something that we have a lot of real-world experience with. And so, you know, for me, I really think that it all boils down to the relationship that we have with technology. And I think that human beings in general have a love-hate relationship with the technology. I mean, we love all the stuff that it does for us, and then we end up depending on it, and then we kind of hate the fact that if you take it away, there's a good chance that we'll all, you know, die rapidly in large numbers. And so I think that what you see a lot in fiction is that it can be really cathartic to externalize this complicated relationship we have with technology into this easy to focus on and this easy to shoot at and run away from form, which is like the killer robot. And it's right there, and it's us against them, right? So the hero strides in, and he shoots the robot in the face, and they battle it out, and then the hero walks away bloodied, but he won, you know? And the sort of message is that we can survive without our technology. You know, we're the ones that matter. And you know, it's not that simple in reality, but it can be really cathartic to have that in your fiction. So the dystopias outnumber the utopias, and I don't necessarily actually think that's a bad thing, and I don't necessarily think it means that we really expect that we in reality that we'll have negative interactions with robots whenever they do become sentient. I mean, at the end of the day, human beings are interested in dangerous stuff. We like poisonous spiders. You know, this is the reason that we have Shark Week. You know, one day was not enough. You need, you know, we'd love to have these sort of simulations of what it's going to look like if all the shit hits all the fans at once. And so, you know, I think that we have these things just to sort of mentally go through them and to experience them and to experience the drama. But I don't know how much it actually has to do with what's really going to happen when we really do start making improvements and start really interacting with sentient machines in our day-to-day lives.
So, I think like others, you know, technology itself is neutral, but again, I think that when we think about these issues, this is again where, you know, this red herring of looking at human intelligence and saying, oh my goodness, I'm going to get scared of them when they get to human intelligence, it is a red herring. It doesn't actually help us think about the threats and think about the problems, because it's not intelligence that's the problem, but it's intent, and it's the sign or the side effects of their intent that are the problem. I mean, if you were walking down a dark alley at night, and, you know, a really big guy starts walking towards you, you don't stand there thinking, gee, I hope he's not too intelligent. You know, it's not intelligence that's the threat, okay? It's the intent, it's the side effects, it's how sloppy that some of the, you know, it's how sloppy some of the coding's going to be blunt. Okay, that's what's going to cause some of the issues. So while the technology...
The mathematicians always blame it on the coders.
It is. Yeah, it's the side effects. So you know, we do remember the bad stuff. There's going to be good stuff, there's going to be bad stuff. The thing is, the bad stuff could be really bad, and I think that's kind of why we have, you know, this fascination with what could go wrong, because in many ways it's more interesting and probably more worth us worrying about than what could go right.
See, this is why I love writing about the relationship we have with technology, because, I mean, what you're saying is that basically the technology raises the moral stakes. Like, a good person can be better with technology, and a bad person can be much, much worse. And so at the end of the day, it becomes like, how much do we trust ourselves? You know, mm-hmm. When we look in the mirror, do we see genocidal maniacs, you know, that are gonna, we're gonna destroy ourselves? Or do we see, you know, do we have like this Sagan sort of view that we're gonna transcend and go into outer space and do all these amazing things with our technology? I love it. That's all I want to say.
Awesome. Well, we've talked a lot about how AIs will treat us. How should we be treating AIs? Chris?
Well, the interesting thing, I mean, you know, I know of no scientific reason why artificial intelligence machines can't have the same kind of consciousness, or maybe a different kind of consciousness than we have. There's no scientific reason for my mind why they can't be sentient, whatever that means. And, you know, we're sentient, or we believe we're sentient, and so therefore I see no reason why the same thing can't be true of a machine. What that means is I actually know of no scientific reasons why machines can't suffer. And I think that actually does give some pause, because it does say, so, you know, how should we be treating these devices. And obviously there is an element of scale, there is an element of level, of degree. Back in the old days of the arguments between Searle and Clark, you know, the argument was about, you know, is my thermostat sentient, and if it is, how should I treat it? Obviously, with degree, we are going to have to start understanding some of this stuff and realizing how we're going to work morally with these creatures. Did anybody go to the Beena 48 definition? Wasn't it odd when they put the cover back over her? You know, it's a very there's some odd things there. There's a researcher called Freedom Baird, and she has come up with this interesting equivalent to the Turing test. Where what she does is she gets young children and she gets them to hold things upside down and see how long they can hold them upside down. Like, she'll give them a Barbie doll and get them to hold it upside down, and they can happily hold it upside down for a long time. And then, you know, she'll give them a gerbil and they'll hold it upside down, but they can't hold it upside down for very long before, you know, the empathy starts to kick in. And she gave them Furbies, and sure enough, Furbies were somewhere in between. You know, they couldn't hold them upside down quite as long as they could a Barbie doll, but they could hold it for longer than a gerbil. So there is this idea that researchers are beginning to look at, and at least our emotional responses to other intelligences. And I think there's a lot more to be done in that area and to understand.
By the way, I was at the Beena 48 talk. I was in the very last row right by the door because I read Daniel's book and I knew what could happen. I was going to be the first one out.
Robots are methodical. They just start killing from the front to the back. So you have plenty of time to get out.
William.
Yeah, so I certainly don't disagree with Chris at all. And I think I'm going to agree with Daniel as well. So I'll bring out a different aspect of it, which is that when we look at how we treat disadvantaged people, one of the solutions that we often jump to is education. That if we want to get kids out of poverty, we give them education. If we want to jumpstart a whole nation, we try to bring them education. And I think that is one of the keys to positive contribution in society. And I would want to see well-rounded AI, because what scares me is a specialized algorithm that doesn't really see the big picture, right? I don't want a Wall Street trader bot that will do anything to achieve its goals. I want a well-rounded trader bot that understands the repercussions of what it's doing. So I'm all for education for AI.
So listen, Chris's point about the fact that maybe machines can suffer kind of gives me pause, because it makes me feel a little bit like a jerk for what I'm about to say. But I really kind of have a humanist viewpoint on this, you know. So we're going to start interacting with machines in our day-to-day lives that are going to look really very realistic. They're going to look like people. They're going to look like animals. And I think that they should have ethical, they should have basically moral rights, but only insofar as it affects human beings. And so, for instance, is it okay to, I was just been watching some old Red Dwarf, and there's this toaster that he's very obsessed. It's got AI, and it's obsessed with serving toast. And it says, you know, do you guys want toast? And everyone says, no. And it says, but the whole meaning of my life is to give people toast. Don't you want some toast? And they shred it. They destroy the toaster. And I think it's actually okay to destroy a toaster, because there's no conflicting sort of ethical message there, right? But is it okay to take a very lifelike puppy, let's say it's indistinguishable from a real puppy, and to harm it or put it in a microwave or just not feed it? Well, I don't want my kid doing that, right? Because I can see that there's a message there that that conflicts with normal. Oh, and by the way, can we play this?
Working on it.
Cool. Yeah, so the thing is, machines are now getting lifelike enough that when you interact with them...
Should I press play?
Yeah, just you go for it. You interact with them, you start to... Oh, boy. You start to get your own sort of empathy triggers, triggering. So see, someone kicks this machine, and you see how it balances? Does that look like a machine in the way that it makes the movement? Well, just the kicking part. No, you know, that looks like a baby horse or some kind of animal. And whenever you see it kicked, it makes you think, wow, that's probably not okay to kick that. And you know, and I think that's the level to which machines should have which we should think about whether they're suffering or not. There's research that's sort of kind of like this Furby research, the holding things upside down, at the University of Washington, where they have kids interact with machines, and then the machines demand rights to different levels. So the kid will be playing tic-tac-toe with a machine, the machine will make a dumb move, and in some of the experiments, the researcher will say, "Wow, you're stupid, machine." And the machine, which has a little virtual face, will sometimes just say nothing. And then other times it'll say, "You know, that's not cool. Don't tell me I'm stupid. You know, you shouldn't say that kind of stuff to somebody." And when you ask the kids later about this, about the AI that they were playing, whether it's okay to be mean to it, their responses are totally in line with whether the machine demanded moral treatment. If the machine was silent, then the kids, the lesson is, yeah, you can do whatever you want, I guess. And you think about now, we interact with new technology all the time, like cell phones. We're constantly deluged with this new stuff, and we're just working out our own solutions to, as to what's socially acceptable. Can you, you know, look at your cell phone at the dinner table? Can you not? You know, and that's annoying, but this is a real problem for roboticists, because on one hand, you have to design a safe product, right? It can't kill anybody. But now there's this whole ethical dimension. You know, are you gonna raise a generation of sociopaths because they've watched people abuse human-like machines for their whole childhoods? And so this is a huge responsibility for roboticists. And I don't know if roboticists are really up for it. You know, there are whole areas of research on this. So, you know, the job just got even harder, basically, is what happened. So that's my...
All right. If you have a question, I'll kind of leave it up to you guys. You can either queue up, raise your hand, but we're coming up on the last question, so get ready. But what we're all here for is to answer this question. What can we do to best prepare for the inevitable upcoming robot uprising? William?
Well, it is a little known fact that robots cannot actually perceive the color orange. So dress like me. You'll be invisible. You know, I was going to originally...
Or join a cult.
Actually, I was just watching some RoboCup, and they use those bright colors to track themselves. So,
yes, all these soccer-playing robots will swarm to protect me. You know, so I was going to answer this about, you know, like building fortified bunkers, which I think we promised. So now we've mentioned it, we've delivered, and it's done with. You know, the answer, I think, is not like that we're going to create Asimov's three laws of robotics, not least of which because Asimov showed that was, you know, full of unsolvable ethical dilemmas. But what I think is actually really interesting is the way that online social networks are changing people's behavior, where you have a large portion of people participating who are very concerned about what their online reputation is. And so I think the opportunity is to codify more social norms into the online social networks. Because one of the reasons is that, you know, there's one of Gene's favorite books is The Nurture Assumption, which is basically all about how nothing has a greater effect on our behavior than peer influence, except genetics. So what I'd love to see on LinkedIn or Twitter or Facebook is some measure of social reputation that includes, you know, trustworthiness, peacefulness, and social contribution. And then I'd like to make sure that the AI all participate in those networks so that the same peer influence effects work on both people and AI alike. And if anyone knows anyone working on stuff like that, I'd love to know about it.
Well, personally, my approach is I'm filling my bunker at home with good quality scotch, and I would advise everybody else does the same.
Come in here, please.
I think that the interesting thing here, and again, you know, coming back to the notion of singularity being dangerous, if the idea is taking our focus away from where we are now. Because you know how stunningly successful we've been in controlling spam and controlling viruses. You know, I mean, we are in a situation where our interdependence with technology is such that that we are very, very vulnerable at the moment. And it's important to understand the carrying capacity of the Earth, okay, has been raised by technology. If some of that technology collapses, then the carrying capacity of the Earth is going to collapse, okay, which means that physically less people will be able to survive on this planet. And I think we are in a situation where we're not fully understanding some of our interdependencies with technology. So I think that, you know, apart from the Scotch, I would definitely recommend that we start to understand better how interdependent we are with technology and how that affects the carrying capacity of the Earth.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think there's no stopping this train that we're on. I mean, there's no stopping progress, right? And although, like, you know, we talked about in the last question, I think it's really important that the people that are building technology try to look for ways that it can be misused, and they try to make sure that it's safe and it's not going to just obviously kill everybody. There's no way to cover all your bases there. And the solution is really not to, I think, run away into a bunker or even think of sort of the easy, you know, robot versus human situation. I mean, the solution is to keep building technology. And I'm kind of an optimist. I think that mostly human beings are good, you know, and I think that when the good outweighs the bad, we're going to be okay in the end. And so for that reason, I think we should, on a specific level, continue to empower ourselves with this technology. Specifically, you think, you know, robots versus humans, but as it turns out, we can incorporate a lot of their abilities into ourselves. You know, so there's neural prosthetics, there's real prosthetics. Why don't we just, you know, why don't we all just get the retinal implants and the neural implants and take advantage of all this awesome research and hardware that's been developed and add the cycles to our own, you know? And I'd be remiss not to mention that that's exactly what I cover in my next book, Amped, coming out June 5th, this summer. Yeah, so I think we should become the robots.
We should all become robots. Awesome. Well, so if you like what Daniel Wilson has had to say, you'll love his books, Robopocalypse, and Amped is coming out when?
June 5th.
June 5th. And if you are interested in what William had to say, you'll love his books, Avogadro Corporation and AI Apocalypse.
And I don't have a book, so.
Yet. And, you know, one of the things about William is he's a consummate note taker. He's assembling a set of resources, so all these sort of obscure concepts that you might have heard, he'll put into a some sort of document. So just if you want that, give William a business card, email him at williamhertling@gmail.com or sign up for his mailing list. And we're actually having a meetup at 6 p.m. Oops, at 7 p.m.? 6 p.m.
7 p.m.
7 p.m. tonight at Mako Sushi. So if you're interested in meeting these folks and hanging around Kindred Spirits, tonight's tonight. And Daniel Wilson's book signing is on the fourth floor today at the Convention Center at 11 a.m. So, all right, questions.
Hi, my name is Roberto Moctezuma, and I graduated from HP also. So, two things. One is, you mentioned the rise of computational power, William. And I think you also spoke about the notion of algorithms and tools evolving and crowdsourcing. I think the other piece that is coming of age is sensing and interaction capability, which is any new intelligent being needs to interact with the world to learn, right? And I think that that's one of characteristics that we would all agree needs to be present in an artificial intelligence. So when you look at things like Siri and things like that are interacting with a bunch of people all the time, I think that's another element that's needed for this thing to rise. And when it rises, I was thinking whether artificial life, and this is my question, you see it as a prerequisite or as a precursor through what, to what we've been talking around here, which is AI that is self-conscious. When life was created on the planet, it first became intelligent, but not necessarily self-conscious. So I have the idea that when it arises, and I see that this is going to happen, it most likely will not be self-conscious at first, but it will be alive in a sense, and then at some point in time, it'll become self-conscious. And as to whether that would mean that they're good and bad, I guess it would depend on what's their Darwinian intent, what is driving their evolution, right? I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, so I'll take a couple of those. I think your point about sensing technologies is a really important one, and certainly a lot of the research that's going on haptic interfaces, things like that. And at the moment, we think about haptic interfaces for us, and then you've got to start thinking about haptic interfaces for the robots. And I think that some of that is actually going to be a fascinating move through. One of the things we didn't talk about very much, though, which is quite interesting, is that
you know, we're now in a point where we don't have to think about the consciousness or the goal engine or whatever we want to call it actually being embodied in the robot device itself. At one point, we always thought, okay, robots, and they'd have these processors there. But now we know, because we're doing it, that actually the consciousness is actually going to be out in virtual space. And I do think that makes things very interesting, because you're going to have both robots which interact physically, or the kind of robots we're already seeing which interact virtually in the virtual space. So so I do think that those are that's very important. Those, both those sides, and that's why, you know, I use the example of both, you know, a TraderBot and Stuxnet, which actually has physical interaction capabilities.
Yeah, in the research I've seen, whenever you're using evolution in order to get some kind of simulated evolution in order to get a great solution, it ends up being something you do well before you actually create the end product, you know, or even that's one way to get a good starting place for your behavior, you know, and then you simulate it in all this, you know, simulated world, and you evolve the great answer, and then you implement it, and then of course it doesn't really work in reality, but you have a good starting point, you know.
You know, one of the things that I would wonder about is the connection between consciousness and tool use. Which I'm sure that Chris could comment more on, right? We don't have a lot of tool-using species, and what is it that enables that? And if you don't have consciousness, then are you able to use tools, and does that then restrict the domain of what AI can do to grow beyond what their natural sort of abilities are?
The point about where consciousness in evolution came about is still being debated, and largely it's being debated because nobody knows how to define consciousness. There's a very interesting book which I really recommend by a guy called Julian Jaynes. It's called The Origin of Consciousness in the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind. It's actually a really interesting historical view of human consciousness, and actually argues that human consciousness actually is a very recently emerging trait, that actually you only have to go back a few thousand years before we as a species were conscious in the way that we think of as consciousness. I think there's a lot more there's a lot more research to be done in this area about what it means to be conscious. But you're absolutely right. I mean, things aren't going to be intelligent before they have the kind of consciousness we would recognize. And I think we are in the state where we already have intelligence. You know, some of these things out there already are intelligence. Whether they have our kind of consciousness or not, and whether they can have that, that's, I think, still to be discussed. Maybe they'll have a different kind of consciousness, you know.
Next question.
Hi. I wrote a thesis in 2007 basically asking, is the internet AI? Thought about it a lot, and one of, I think, Turing's quotes was, when true AI happens, no one will even notice. And I thought about it quite a bit, and then it hit me with SOPA, and that the internet reacted, and it became visceral, and it defended itself from an attack. And to me, that was consciousness, and it just kind of happened, and no one even noticed. And I just wondered if you'd elaborate on that.
You know, this is, on the tool point, I'm just going to briefly talk, because I think you probably have a better answer, but on the tool point, it is true that the tools, we co-evolve with our tools, and they shape us, you know, and sometimes it's not clear whether the tool's talking or the person, you know, and you think about, you know, what I read somewhere about, you know, grass, you know, human beings really like having flat spaces with grass on it, and as a result, you know, grass is like really one, you know, thanks to human beings, and then we do all kinds of things to protect it. And you can find a lot of examples of sort of technology and situations that we sort of nurture and protect at all costs. And it's not clear whether the tail is wagging the dog or not.
I have the same thought, which is, you know, on the nature of symbiotic relationships, like the bacteria that lives in our gut that we're dependent upon, but we provide the perfect host space for it. You know, one thing that I think about is recommendation algorithms, which I've worked with a bunch at HP, and the fact that recommendation algorithms can be considered a kind of AI, and yet it's fundamentally dependent upon humans providing the input data. If you didn't have any humans, there would be no intelligent behavior emerging out of the system. So is it the humans providing the intelligence or the machine? And the answer is it's both. It's a symbiotic relationship.
Hi. A couple years ago, I read an article about a robot scientist that had been invented by a British laboratory that actually discovered new knowledge. Like, it was able to mine data, form a hypothesis, and then using the robots in the laboratory, test its hypothesis until it reached a conclusion. I just kind of wanted to get your thoughts on sort of that AI learning process, being able to apply the same principles that humans use, and how that can help advance and make, you know, if combined with like the power, semantic power of stuff like Watson, how that can be used to form artificial intelligence.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting area. And back when I was working on evolvable hardware, we had this interesting piece, this interesting dilemma where what we were doing, we were using self-modifying hardware. We were running. Separately, we were running genetic algorithms to do design work. And it turned out that we were working on a particular piece of media processing. And we genetic algorithms came up with this awesome way to lay out the data bus that we had never thought of. And we sat in a room and we said, how do we patent this and who is the inventor? Okay, because it was actually the tool that did the inventing. It was not actually, the, you know, we couldn't point, we could point to the team that wrote the tool, but they never invented this data bus, this particular way. It was playing fast and loose with the timing on the data bus in a way that we would never have thought about. Okay, and so I think that we do have this this interesting situation where we're building tools that create things. And, you know, and so, you know, when we think about, you know, robot researchers, I mean, you can parse that in two different ways. You know, do we have a robot researcher or a robot researcher? You know, there's two different things. So I think we're going to see more of that. You know, like I say, fundamentally, the process of design, and I apologize to any creatives here, the process of design is a search problem. And basically what we do is we write better search algorithms.
You know, they say
we have 30 seconds.
They say scientists stand on the shoulders of giants. You know, I think more and more often we're standing on the shoulders of our algorithms. He ran away.
Very good. Let's see here. Closing thoughts.
Oh, okay. Hey.
Oh. Talk fast.
Hello, I can talk fast. Good to see you. So I think that AI is sexy. And I'm curious, do you think that we will have to pass the threshold of the Turing test before we can be turned on by a conversation with artificial intelligence?
5 seconds each.
Absolutely not. No. I mean, human beings, we have so much social machinery that's constantly at work, and so much of it has to do with sex, that we just do all the work for the machines. You know, we see faces in tortillas, and whenever you're interacting with the machine, it has to do very little work in order to make us feel like we're interacting with a living creature, and probably even less to make us turned on.
Perfect. I once went to a talk by Robin Williams, not the comedian, but the Mac woman, and she once gave a great talk about having sex over a modem, and the point was she was making when she did this. Is that
why don't you guys bring this up like 30 minutes ago? This is like awesome.
The point that she was making at the time was actually in these cases it's less about what the communication channel is like, and it's less about who you're interacting with than your personal belief in who you're reacting with. And so I do think that we don't have to pass the Turing test.
Placebo Turing test?
Yeah, I think that, well, we already are having these things. You know, we already talk to our cars. We already, you know, and I don't, you know, I talk to my dog, and my dog doesn't pass the Turing test, you know, so.
Out of respect for the organizers, we need to conclude. By the way, I didn't talk about Chris's desired outcomes, and he's just looking for fellow thinkers, so he would love to meet you as well. Thank you very much.
And I'm signing books in 30 minutes.